I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday afternoon. Five states have doctor-assisted dying, and there are other states that have it under serious consideration. California will be having a hearing this week, actually. There's also a lawsuit in New York. Euthanasia isn't permitted anywhere in the U.S. Direct action by a doctor to take a step, to take a life, it's a step that has proven to be too far, even by states where indirect action is allowed, letting physicians prescribe pills that patients themselves then swallow. This hour, we're going to be looking at this whole issue of how we die, really, is what we're talking about. Retro Report is a fairly, I think it's a fairly new thing done by the New York Times, and it does this wonderful, it does a video that gives you a historical perspective on an issue. So it goes back to the 90s here, and Dr. Jack Kevorkian, many of you will remember him. Some considered him an angel, some considered him a devil. He spent 8 years in prison. So we'll talk about that, but it gives you this historical reference, which is really good, and then is in collaboration with the New York Times. So they present an extensive review of lots of different issues, and this one, it's on the Right to Die movement. So joining us this hour is Jill Rosenbaum-Meyer, contributing producer, writer at Retro Report. We'll be welcoming phone calls for her. I'm sure that we'll have many of them because people have strong thoughts about this issue. And here's how you can reach us, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter, and that's @KDunnShow. Hi, Jill. Thank you very much for being with us again. Hi.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, our great pleasure. I had almost forgotten about Dr. Jack Kevorkian. He was a very odd man, but he certainly made this issue front and center in the country during the 90s, didn't he?
Well, he was an odd man, and he did make this issue front and center. And, you know, he had a style that one of the folks that we interviewed who knew him pretty well said that he was in your face. And I think he felt like if he was going to get the country's attention, he had to be outrageous in some way. And he was. But the issue he raised was really an important one. And I think what people forget is that, you know, in the few years leading up to Jack Kevorkian, we had just come to the point where we would allow someone to, say, have their feeding tube disconnected or, you know, be taken off life support, things that we take for granted. But even those were controversial not long before Jack Kevorkian.
Was it really? It was. I don't remember the debate about having feeding tubes disconnected.
Well, there were some cases that went to the Supreme Court, actually.
Oh, really?
Yeah, in the 80s. So, you know, he came along, and his idea was that individuals who were suffering should be able to end their lives. And he was a pathologist, so he was a person who researched people's health after they died to figure out cause of death and things like that. He wasn't someone who actually had a practice or treated patients. He was just very, very interested in death, and he invented this machine that people could be hooked up to and push a button and essentially end their life. And, you know, that attracted a lot of attention.
And then one day he pushed the button, right, on national TV?
Well, you know, it's a bit of a saga. He first had individuals do it themselves, and the state of Michigan attempted to prosecute him, and it turned out there was no law in Michigan barring assisted suicide. And then they passed a law, and then they tried to prosecute him again, and what happened was he conducted videotaped interviews with the people that he was going to help to die in advance of their death, and he would play these interviews. His lawyer, Jeffrey Feiger, would play these interviews at the trials, and when the jurors would see the suffering that these patients were enduring, you know, they just couldn't convict him. So for a while, he kind of was off the hook, and he was being permitted to do this, but then he decided that this was not enough, and that he had to do euthanasia, and he filmed himself essentially taking someone's life, had this journalist that he knew, Jack Lessenberry, get in touch with Mike Wallace from 60 Minutes, and Wallace interviewed him and played this video on national television where Kevorkian was essentially killing the patient.
Right.
And that was too much. And for that, he went to prison for 8 years.
Mm-hmm. Arthur, do you know if there are a lot of ways that physicians can give you drugs or whatever to end life? Or is it a pretty narrow path that you can only take a certain kind of pill?
Well, you know, there are only 5 states where this is legal. And for most of them, it's pretty new. But in Oregon, it's been legal for 17 years now. And in Oregon, the physician is not permitted to do it, you know, to take the patient's life, him or herself. They prescribe pills, and the patient takes them. And they have to do it themselves. They have to be of sound mind, and they have to be capable of administering it themselves. And that's, of course, to prevent, you know, taking advantage of anybody or taking their life when it's not their wish. You know, there are other ways. You know, I don't know that they're legal anywhere, though. In fact, one of the things that was very interesting that I learned in researching this story is that part of why people suffered so much, you know, before this debate really got going, was because doctors were afraid to give patients lots of pain medicine because
yes.
they could inadvertently kill them. And so there was this fear if you gave a patient a lot of morphine, say, if they were suffering terribly and the morphine killed them, you know, you could be prosecuted. So, you know, I think it was a very different world than it is today.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk a little bit about Oregon, way ahead of the national curve on this particular issue. Why? What happened in Oregon that allowed them to have physician-assisted deaths for 17 years?
Well, I think a couple things. Right around the same time that Kevorkian was active, there was this nascent right-to-die movement around the country. A British fellow named Derek Humphrey had started the Hemlock Society, and he wrote a book called Final Exit that was about this topic. And there was Kevorkian, and then there was a very lovely physician in Rochester, New York, named Dr. Timothy Quill,
mm-hmm.
who just a few months after Kevorkian's first patient wrote an article in a medical journal about how he had helped one of his longtime patients end her life. And then in Oregon, there was a member of the state Senate who was dying, and he tried to get one of these bills through, and it didn't pass, but he kind of started the debate there as well. And so anyway, a group of citizens in Oregon came together and did a ballot initiative. There had been 2 prior attempts, one in Washington and one in California. Those would have permitted euthanasia as well as assisted suicide. And the folks in Oregon, I think, wisely saw that that was just never going to fly. You know, it was just going to be seen as too dangerous. So their bill had really stringent safeguards. Doctors couldn't administer the drugs. The patient had to request it twice. They had to ask more than one doctor. You know, there really had to be proof that they had 6 months or less to live. It was a pretty carefully drawn law. And so it passed. And I think people were, you know, surprised.
Mm-hmm. So tell me, how have courts dealt with this difference here? What's the difference between saying that you want a feeding tube disconnected, which you know you're going to die eventually? It may take a week. It may take longer than that. It might be shorter than that. Or taking pills in which you would die more immediately. Don't they both do the same thing? It's just a matter of time.
Well, it's interesting. Dr. Quill, who I mentioned earlier, was a part of a case that went to the U.S. Supreme Court in 1997 asking that very question. They said that it was discriminating against patients who were not on feeding tubes or life support machines of some type, not to let them take their lives when people who were on these machines and could just disconnect them could make this decision. The Supreme Court didn't agree. You know, at this point, those are, you know, considered distinct medical issues.
Mm-hmm. And what about the issue of pain? In the documentary, I think the gentleman's name is Michael, who's suffering from cancer, and he's really in a great deal of pain, and he decides to not eat, and it takes him a while to die. Have we reached a point with medical advances that if you have cancer, if you have something that's just debilitating and really hurts, that drugs can take care of that pain completely or not?
Well, you know, that is a very complex question. It might be that you would have to give the person so many drugs or so much medication that they would be essentially sedated. So for somebody who wants to remain awake and conscious, that's a, you know, it's what Dr. Quill calls them hard cases. You know, when you look at the Oregon data, they've studied the people who have chosen to use their death with dignity law, and most of them say that physical pain was not necessarily the main reason why they chose to do this. So a lot of times it's a psychological pain that goes along with their suffering, or it's a desire not to be just sort of sedated into oblivion. You know, in the case of Michael Marasco, he had cancer that spread to his bones, and every time he would stand up, practically, you know, another one would break.
Oh.
So, you know, there's pain is a different thing for different people, I think. And, you know, that's the only way I can answer it.
What's interesting is that most people I know have thought this out for themselves long before they're in a terminally ill situation. But some people don't think it out. And it's interesting with family members. I've noticed in my own family when people are approaching dying how there can be just a complete difference of opinion. Some members wanting to stay alive as long as possible, hoping for a miracle, I think, and others realizing that life is over now and I'm comfortable with it. It all does relate in some ways to how we feel about death, doesn't it?
Oh, I think it does. And, you know, I have a couple things to say about that. One is the whole Brittany Menard case,
yes.
You know, the young woman from California. I think what that raised is that most of us, when we've reached a certain stage of life, have thought about it, but maybe younger people haven't. And I think that was, you know, one of the things that made her case so compelling.
It was.
I think the other thing is that we Americans are not very good about having discussions about the end of life, generally. And there's an interesting movement going on, started by Ellen Goodman, the former Boston Globe columnist, called the Conversation Project. And what they're trying to do is get people to talk to their loved ones while they're still healthy about what they would want at the end of life. Because so often, you do end up with families, you know, in the ICU, and you have one sibling who wants every measure done, and the other sibling who says, oh, no, I think mom's done and ready to go, and they have no playbook.
Right.
So, you know, one of the things that perhaps will come out of this debate about physician aid in dying will also just be a greater freedom for people to talk about how they want the end of their lives to be handled.
And give me an update on California. Has the hearing taken place this week?
You know, I actually think it's tomorrow.
Oh, it is.
But I'm not 100% sure.
But the chances of having this in California are pretty great, or is it contentious still?
You know, politics is a strange business, and I would not want to get into predicting what will or won't pass. You know, there certainly is momentum, but there's also, you know, these laws have... For example, in New Jersey last year, it passed through one house of the legislature. You know, there's been debate going on in Maryland, in Connecticut. But, you know, it's hard to know how people will vote. And, you know, there is religious opposition to physician-aided dying. And, you know, some of the disability rights organizations are opposed. So it's hard to know, you know, where that will go. But it's certainly a reinvigorated debate right now, and there are more than a dozen states where there's some legislative activity happening.
That's quite a few, isn't it?
Yeah, and a lot of it's happened since Brittany Menard died.
We welcome phone calls. Jill Rosenbaum-Meyer is our guest. She's a contributing writer-producer at Retro Report, and their current issue looks at physician-assisted dying. It's in five states in various forms, and it's being considered perhaps tomorrow, we think, in California, in New York as well, and it's being considered not as far down the line legislatively, but being considered in many other states as well. The video report looks at Dr. Kevorkian, Jack Kevorkian, who was at the forefront of this movement some years ago by providing drugs that people who wanted to end their lives, who were very sick, were able to press a button and the drugs were administered and they died. He later figured that doctors ought to be able to do this as well. So he called Mike Wallace and said, I want to do this and I've got a video. I'm going to video my pressing the button. And he did. And it was on CBS. And then Dr. Kevorkian was put in jail for 8 years. But there are so many issues involved here. Obviously, doctors take an oath to keep people healthy. You know, that's what they're thinking about. They're not thinking about dying that much. In terms of what we decide for ourselves, maybe that changes over the course of our lives, or if we're deciding for a loved one, we may have differences of opinion in our families. What do you think about all of this? It really makes you think to the depth of your being. As to what's right here, what's moral, what should we do? Here's our number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. And we're on Twitter as well, and that's at K Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour two of our show tomorrow. During this hour, Frank Bruni will join us. Frank is a New York Times columnist, and he has a new book, Where You Go Is Not Who You Will Be. It's an antidote to the college admissions mania. So those are our shows for tomorrow. Let's welcome phone calls. We're talking about physician-assisted dying this hour of the program. 800-486-8655 is our number. And Dennis in Wautoma is our first caller. Hi, Dennis.
Hi. This is something that I struggled with for a few years when I was watching my parents waste away with Alzheimer's. Mm. It's a very sad disease, and I'm not so much afraid of dying. I'm afraid of having my kids watch me live with Alzheimer's. And I wish there was something I could have done for my parents, and I just hope something can be done.
Well, how would you even deal with that in Oregon? Because as the patient, you have to be able to verbally say, I understand, twice, 15 days apart, that you want to be able to take this pill. If you have Alzheimer's, are you even able to do that, Jill?
No, in Oregon you would not be. First of all, Alzheimer's is not, it's a fatal disease, but by the time you're within 6 months of death, you are no longer competent to make that decision. So, no, people with Alzheimer's would not be covered by this. Interestingly, the very, very first patient that Dr. Kevorkian helped to die was a 54-year-old woman from Oregon named Janet Atkins. And she had early stages of Alzheimer's and did not want to die from it. And, I mean, did not want to, disappear from it, essentially. Mm. And he was heavily, heavily criticized for doing this because, of course, she wasn't a terminally ill patient.
So is it true in the other states that you have to be able to verbally give consent to this 15 days apart? How do they determine if you are...
Well, the laws are not all identical, but everybody must be able to give consent. You know, one of the things that the opponents of physician-aided dying really, really worry about is people being coerced in some way to do this, people whose families might see them as a burden,
yeah,
or people who require a great deal of care, like Alzheimer's patients do. And so they really want to make sure that no one has this foisted upon them.
Caleb from Mount Horeb sends this message. He said that we tend to show more sympathy to our animals by euthanizing them when they're suffering than we do to our humans.
You know, I've heard this said before, and, I think it's a very complex equation, how our society comes to terms with the value of human life, people's feelings about the value of their own lives. You know, and somehow with animals, we don't ascribe to them souls and all these other sort of things that, you know, it's just much more complicated with people. And so I think there are some who feel that way very strongly, and there are others, particularly more religious folks, who don't think that. And, you know, we're a democracy, and I think it's sometimes hard to get to, you know, the place where everybody feels comfortable.
Yes. Joe is next. Hi, Joe.
Hi.
Hi, Joe.
Good afternoon. My father worked in the paper mill his entire career, and he got asbestos or mesothelioma of the lung. Mm. And once he was clinic figured out what was wrong with him, they gave him 18 months to live and said, enjoy the rest of your life, and this is what you've got left. And my father accepted that, and he was very proud of where he worked, and he had no ill will against his work or anything. It said he always said it gave him a new home and six kids and new cars, and he was never bitter. He was a very, very private man, I guess my entire life. I'm 58 years old, and he died some years back, but I never saw him in a pair of shorts or short sleeve shirts. He was embarrassed to be, his feet or anything like that, or his arms or legs or whatnot. One time I saw him in a pair of swim trunks when he came out of the dressing room, and he more or less made a beeline for the lake because he was very embarrassed, but that was old school. And in the end, as he grew sicker and sicker and sicker, day by day, week by week, month by month, he went from a 200-pound man down to 94 pounds in the very end when he passed away. But in the end, the last approximate month, the simple weight of a T-shirt or a undershorts or even a pair of socks, he could not bear. He was so uncomfortable because he was just, you know, he was dying. He was shriveling up to absolutely nothing. And in the end, his brother made him something that it was like a box he could put his feet in, because the simple weight of a bed sheet on his feet was too much excruciating pain. So in the very end, my dad laid there stark buck naked, and people would come to say goodbye, and I knew this was killing him. Even though he was dying physically, I know inside emotionally, for this poor guy to lay there, it all six of us kids, it just tore us up to see our poor dad just laying there, knowing, you know, he had his mind, but he couldn't speak much anymore in the very end because it was taking his life. But we felt so bad for him because he was such a private man, and he was, we knew that this was driving him absolutely crazy inside in the mind, let alone the physical part, that the cancer was draining his life. And us six kids in the end, we kind of all made a pact and said, boy, if any of us get in this situation, we certainly hope that there's something somehow that can help us for ourselves. He couldn't make that decision because his Dr. Kevorkian thing back then was not there yet.
What a poetic story of dying with dignity, isn't it, Jill? Oh, my goodness.
I'm sorry for the suffering that you all endured, both, you know, on his behalf and I'm sure yourselves. One thing that has changed a lot, you know, when Dr. Quill took his case to the Supreme Court, the court in its ruling said that doctors could give medication to relieve suffering, you know, without worrying about being prosecuted if that medication ended their lives. And so my guess is that someone in your father's situation today would be able to get better pain control. He would probably have better care so that at least his physical suffering wouldn't be so great.
Yes. Thank you so much for your call, Jill. Let's go to Ross in Kaukauna. Hi, Ross.
Hey, how's it going? So, you know, I think what everybody really needs to do in order to, you know, like get this question answered in some ways is do what I did, is get a living will for, you know, that way your kids know what to do and that's what you want, you know. And also the whole Kevorkian thing, you know, it's just so weird to think he went to jail for just the footage is what got him in trouble. The footage of killing someone is, you know, and if that's going to be the standard, you know, footage of people dying like that gets you time in jail. Geez, you think, I mean, George Bush and Dick Cheney should be in jail for all of the footage from the Iraq War for all the people they killed, eh?
Well, I must confess, I've never equated them with Jack Kevorkian before.
No, I haven't either.
Well, you know, a living will, if you're in a state that doesn't have this, won't get you there. I don't know if you're aware of that. You can say in your living will not to put you on life support, but, you know, if you are suffering from something that has a drawn-out deterioration or a drawn-out death and you're not, for example, we interviewed in our film Diane Rehm, who
yes.
is a public radio host here in Washington, D.C., and her husband had a long, painful death from Parkinson's. He got to the point where he couldn't feed himself, he couldn't walk, he couldn't dress, he couldn't go to the bathroom on his own. He really was ready to die. He asked his doctor for life-ending medication, and in Maryland, where he lived, it was not legal. And so he did something called voluntary cessation of eating and drinking, where you essentially starve yourself to death. And you do it, you know, you can do it with a physician's, you know, a physician caring for you so that when it starts to get really torturous, you can have pain medicine. But, you know, if it's not legal in your state, a living will is just not going to get you the equivalent of what they have in Oregon.
Thank you very much for your call. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show. Where has the medical community, if you poll doctors now, I don't know what the AMA's stance is on this issue or what most doctors think about this now. Is there opposition in the medical community or growing support?
Well, the AMA does not support it. And, you know, there is, I think, a really mixed view among physicians. I don't know what the latest polling is, so whatever I tell you, you know, number-wise, it would be wrong. But I think doctors really are, they disagree. Some believe that it is not their place to end patients' lives and that their role is to be healers. And there are others, you know, and they take that Hippocratic oath of first do no harm literally to mean that if you take someone's life, you are doing harm. There are other physicians who believe that, you know, prolonging someone's suffering is doing harm. So I think, you know, it's a mixed bag with doctors just like it is with everybody else. I think that they are torn.
Mm-hmm. We go next to Jean in Ashland. Hi.
Hi. Oh, this is a very disgusting program.
It's a very what?
You have not even touched on, you just began to, just a few moments ago, saying that the AMA did not approve of it or did not agree. But you have not discussed why at all. You do not discuss why generally religious groups do not believe in supporting this assisted suicide. Suicide is murder. Murder, murder, murder. And we do not do it. We understand, we strive, we read, we grasp, we get from our religious teaching why there is such a thing as suffering. It is all in how you understand it. And it's what you're supposed to do to understand what you're going through. And for me, I don't pass away, I pass on. I have things to do and places to go, and I will take up all the promises of Jesus Christ of Nazareth because that's the way to go. And when he said, "Are you going to leave me too?" they said, "Where will we go? We have no other place to go. You have the answers."
Jill.
Well, as I said earlier, you know, a lot of the opposition to this is religious. And, you know, I think people in a democracy, they're going to have to each side make their case and see what happens. But you're absolutely right that you know, most or many people, religious people, don't agree with this.
Let's go next to Anne in Madison. Hi.
Hi. I wanted to bring up the Hippocratic Oath. I mean, I believe the first part of that is to do no harm. And I'm wondering how it is viewed as doing more harm to let someone go if they're totally terminal, nothing's going to help, they've made the decision with a sound mind, rather than letting them make that choice. I mean, to me, leaving someone in a lingering state of pain and suffering and knowing it's not going to be relieved is a whole lot more harm. How does that issue get resolved in this?
Well, I think that there are some physicians who agree with you, and they believe that it is both compassionate and helpful to alleviate suffering by helping people end their lives. I think there are others who really feel uncomfortable with the idea of a doctor whose job they believe is to cure, taking some affirmative step to help people end their lives. And, you know, I think doctors are individuals, and just like everyone else, they're not of one mind about this.
Well, doctors must know, though, you can be given morphine at the end of your life, and I know that for cancer patients or for others, you can self-administer morphine, right? So do doctors take it upon themselves to tell their patients, now you can only take so much of this morphine or you will die?
Well, you know, I don't know the answer to that except by anecdote, and so I'm afraid to say, well, lots of people do or lots of people don't, but certainly anecdotally, people do. I think one thing that was really interesting for me in researching this was Dr. Quill wrote his article in the New England Journal of Medicine. It was published in 1991, and in it, you know, said that he had given somebody medication that, you know, that she could take herself. And afterward, there was this big debate, and people did say this happens much more often than you know, that doctors quietly do this kind of thing. But there's nobody keeping track of it. I don't have a way to tell you how frequently
right.
It occurs. It does occur, but I don't know how often.
So was he taken to task for doing that?
Well, it was actually really interesting. What happened was they convened a grand jury. Because in New York, unlike Michigan, where Dr. Kevorkian was, in New York State, there was an affirmative law, you know, outlawing physician-assisted suicide. So he was brought before the grand jury, and he tells this great story in our film, actually, that he just, you know, his lawyer told him that he should not testify, that he should take the fifth, and he should just, you know, not say anything. But he believed that if the grand jurors heard the story and saw him, you know, he was no Jack Kevorkian, that they would have compassion and that they would not indict him. And sure enough, that's what happened. He testified before the grand jury, and no criminal charges were brought.
Hmm. He does have a lovely style about him, doesn't he? Very warm, compassionate. All right. Thanks, Ann, for your call. Let's go to Elizabeth in Fish Creek. Hi.
Hi. My dad died about 20 years ago, and he had a terminal glioblastoma, brain cancer. I had made it clear, he was a hospital administrator. He had made it really clear all the time since I was a little girl when his mother died painfully in a long, drawn-out death that was not what he chose. He was extremely specific for many years. I had no question. And we helped him to leave earlier with pain medication. And so, family assisted. And so I have no questions about it, never have, speak openly about it. And because there are times when the law is in contradiction with higher ethics. And I have a deep faith in God. I just interpret it differently than the previous or one of the earlier callers. And I was very sick a few years ago, and had my illness progressed differently, that's a choice I would have also liked to make. However, what would stand on me would be, would I want to potentially put my children in a position to have a legal problem if they help me? So the problem is, not all patients are in a position to do it without assistance. And it's very hard for families, some families, to figure out how to assist a family member without the help of a doctor. But what I can tell you, because I'm so open about it, is that people are very open with me, and I believe that many, many, many families help family members to leave more comfortably earlier than they would have if they had to go to the very last grueling moment, because people speak openly with me as well. the problem is that if we are maintaining our laws the way they are now, people have to do this without the assistance of a professional who can actually help you do it better and make sure there aren't problems.
So, you know, it's interesting. There was a case a couple of years ago in Pennsylvania, and I believe the woman was a nurse who was, her father was getting morphine. He was in hospice care, and he asked her to, you know, give him a bigger dose so that he would die. And somewhere in between her administering the medication and his passing away, the hospice nurse came, who didn't believe that this was an appropriate thing to do, called 911.
Oh.
He was resuscitated, and his daughter was prosecuted. She was ultimately not convicted, but she was prosecuted.
Wow.
That's what I say, wow. Thank you. Unless you had anything more, Elizabeth?
No, thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for your call. We'll take more in a moment. We're talking about end of life and physician-assisted dying this hour of the program. We have as our guest Jill Rosenbaum-Meyer. She's a contributing producer at Retro Report, and she's done news documentary work on PBS, Smithsonian Channel, CBS News, Evening News, ABC News. She's won all kinds of awards, PBS Frontline Film Dollars and Dennis. She's won a National Press Club Award, and her latest work is on this very compelling issue, which is physician-assisted dying. It's the focus of the Retro Report, the video on the New York Times, and a story about this issue as well, giving us the background of Dr. Kevorkian, Dr. Quill, Oregon, why they so many years ago became a state that allowed this, what the restrictions are, and how we feel about it now. 800-486-8655 is the number. The email is talk@WPR.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter at K Dunn Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go next to Caleb in Onalaska. Hi, Caleb.
Hi.
Hi.
Until recently, I was a nurse practicing in an ICU in Iowa, and I wanted to remark on the, something a gentleman said a little bit ago about having those advanced directives like a living will or a durable power of attorney. And you know, because I've watched a lot of people die, sometimes, you know, unexpectedly, or more often, you know, physicians and families and can kind of see these things coming and discuss how aggressive they want treatment to be, and when to withdraw treatment. But I'd like people to know that those documents are not being influential when a person loses their own agency or, you know, ability to speak for themselves. And frequently a person will be kept alive on an intubated on a ventilator against the explicit directions of their, you know, living will, simply because the family is you know, there, and the staff and the physicians are more likely to have to answer to the family than the person who's going to die sooner or later. So I think more important than having a living will or a durable power attorney is sort of have those discussions with your family so that they understand what you want before that time comes.
Jill.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And as I mentioned earlier, there's an interesting new movement called the Conversation Project that actually has on its website samples of conversations and questions that you can have with your loved one if you don't know how to initiate the discussion, so that people don't end up, you know, stuck on ventilators and life support and other things that they would never want to be on. You know, it's hard for someone to say to a doctor, go ahead and disconnect my loved one from this or that machine, because I think that person might feel like they're killing their loved one by making that decision. And I think, you know, if their parent or their sibling or whomever had said to them in advance, this is what I want, mm-hmm. I think it might make it easier.
Thank you so much, Caleb, for your call. Let's go to Katie in Germantown. Hi.
Hi, Kathleen. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
This is such an interesting conversation. I guess my point would be that what I like about this is that it's bringing up good ideas and maybe changing the conversation with the way we talk with our doctors. We only go and see our doctors when we're sick. And I think, you know, maybe we need to deal more with them about being healthy. And, you know, some countries in the East only pay their doctors when they're well, and when they're sick, it's free because they didn't do their job. So I guess that would be my point, is maybe we can change the conversation with our doctors and get them to think a little differently about the end of life and be more open.
You know, it's interesting. I think what you're saying makes sense on more than one level. First of all, just in terms of having openness, we are all going to die, and having openness about the discussion both with your family and with your doctor. But also, one of the things that people disliked about Jack Kevorkian was that the people he helped to die were not his regular patients. You know, he didn't have regular patients. They weren't people he knew well. Whereas with Dr. Quill, you know, in the example of his first patient that he wrote about, it was somebody he had been taking care of for years, who he knew really well, who he'd helped through a long illness. And so I think, you know, the way you look at a physician's role, it could be different depending on his or her relationship with the patient. And I think, you know, in that way, it would be good if people spoke more openly with their doctors about these issues.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Katie, for your call. Robert in Beloit. Hi.
Hi. First of all, I want to say to Kathleen that I listen to your show every single day on the way to work.
Oh, thank you. That's nice.
Second, my point is in the social ethics of assisted suicide. I've noticed that there's more or less a bandwagon due to the fact that Christianity is so interwoven into American society that the religious aspect seems to have much more of a way in than I personally believe that it should. But my question is, do you believe that most doctors or a great deal of them who believe in the assisted suicide and who think that in certain cases it should be allowed, do you think that they don't come out and make themselves open about their feelings on it due to the fact that they're worried about losing their job or losing a reputation?
You know, it's against the law in almost all states. And doctors have medical licenses that they get from the state. I think it's a really complex question, and I don't think you can lump them all together. I really don't know.
Well, I think that's all I have.
All right. Thank you, Robert. Thanks for the call.
Thank you.
May from Appleton writes this: beyond the moral and ethical issues in states where right to die is legal, have there been problems or complications regarding patients' life insurance? While this might seem like it's not a central issue, I can't imagine after planning for the future of one's family that this wouldn't come into play. As someone with children, it's hard to think that they would not be financially stable because of a decision to end one's life. Are there any cases the guest can speak to that address any aspect of this?
Well, I must confess, this is the first time
I know.
Asked this question.
I never thought of that.
I haven't either, but what I would say is that at least in Oregon, you have to be, it has to be asserted by more than one physician that the patient has 6 months or less to live. So I think their life insurance, you know, I really don't know, but I would imagine that it probably isn't impacted because the person is already terminally ill.
Mm-hmm.
But I am not an expert on this. Please don't quote me.
Okay, we won't. You know, I as you said that, I don't know if I'd want a doctor to tell me that, how much time I had left. Would you want somebody to tell you how much time you had left?
Me, personally?
Yeah.
Well, I'm a little bit of a control freak.
Okay. Do you know what you do with it?
You know, I really don't. You know, it would depend on what I was suffering with and how
right.
old I was. And
right.
What I would hope is that I wouldn't go grasping at straws and go hunting for, you know, treatments that were just going to be more
right.
treatment and not really effective. And I think that's actually a really big other discussion about how much we over-treat people who really don't have, you know, a possibility of recovering
right.
because we can't be honest with them about how much time they have left.
Yeah. I just would hope for somebody from the other side to tell me what it is, you know.
Hmm.
I don't know if that's going to happen. I don't think it's happened, right?
I don't know.
No. Thanks. Thanks for the call, Robert. Let's go to Connie in Thorpe, Wisconsin. Hey, Connie. Connie.
Hello.
Hi.
Yes, I'm really enjoying your show. I wanted to talk to the issue of caring for aging parents, and I've been on both ends of the spectrum with my parents. My mother was killed in a tragic car accident about 13 and a half years ago, and I was with her in her dying moments. And then shortly thereafter, my father was diagnosed with Parkinson's, and so my siblings and I over the years have taken care of him in our homes in different stages of his ongoing disease, knowing that at the end of his life we would probably have to put him in some sort of facility because we wouldn't be able to take care of him. And this happened a year and a half ago. But I want to talk about the fact that taking care of an aging parent should not be something that is feared, and we should embrace watching that happen. I thought it was a great privilege to be with my father in the end of his days, and to also be with him when he died this past January. And you know, rather than thinking about ending his life early, you know, we just became advocates for him in the care center that he was in, and were there a lot and enjoyed being with him, even when he wasn't making sense, but, you know, just engaging him and making him as comfortable as possible till the end. But I just would think that families should be more open to planning for how they're going to care for their aging parents or whoever at the end of their life, and realizing what a privilege it is to be there in those moments.
Thank you very much for the call. Jill.
Well, first of all, it sounds like you have a very loving family and a very loving relationship with your father, and that is indeed a gift. And as sad as I'm sure you are to lose him, that, you know, it is something that you were all able to have together. I think what this is about is not families deciding that their elderly or ill loved one should have this. I think it's much more about what the patient might want. And I think that is the thing that you're bringing up is one of the other fears that some of the opponents have, that somehow families will pressure their loved one to exit early. And I think, you know, it's really more, at least what the proponents say, is that it's really more about, you know, what the patient would want, not at all what the caregivers want.
Mm-hmm. Well, we better not take another call or we'll be out of time. Jill, thank you so much. What's the next project, do you know?
Well, I'm researching some things about genetic medicine at the moment, but I can't guarantee that's what it'll be, but perhaps I'll be back on your show in a couple months. And I just did want to say that if people want to watch the Retro Report piece, that it's called A Right to Die with a question mark at the end, mm-hmm. On the New York Times Retro Report page.
Great. It's just a wonderful thing. I'm so glad that it exists.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for being with us.
All right. Thank you very much.
Our guest is Jill Rosenbaum-Meyer. She is the contributing producer of Retro Report, who worked on this physician-assisted dying. And it's the Retro Report and New York Times, and it's on our Facebook page as well. So you can go there to get more info. Thanks to K.P. Whaley for producing the hour, and thanks to Scotty Myers for on-air production in our studios in Milwaukee. Michael Isikoff is joining us tomorrow. He's written a piece that appears today on Yahoo, where he is now the chief investigative correspondent, and he looks at a secret $1.5 million donation from Wisconsin billionaire John Menard, uncovered in Governor Walker's dark money probe. So we will be talking with Michael. And we will also tomorrow be speaking with Mike Bruni about, you know, you skip this hotshot college thing. You don't have to go to Harvard or Yale to have a really spectacular life, but a lot of people have been putting all their eggs in one basket. May not be a good idea. He offers an alternative. He's a columnist for the New York Times. Thanks very much for listening. Until tomorrow.